Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Work Trends with Megan and Biro. Whether you're here to network, learn, or share, we want you to have fun. During this live broadcast and Twitter chat, we'll discuss the future of work with smart and entertaining guests who value today's business and its impact on the world of work for the future. Stay tuned, because we start in 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to another informative Talent Culture Work Trends live podcast and Twitter chat show. No, this isn't Megan Imbiro disguising her voice. My name is Patrick Antrim, and I'm subbing in for Megan as your Work Trends host today while she attends the SHRM conference in New Orleans. So on behalf of Megan and the Talent Culture community, of which I'm a proud member, I want to thank all the partners and sponsors and extend Megan's gratitude and appreciation. So today, I'm really excited about today's show. It's on the topic of leadership, which is one of my favorite topics to talk about, just because of the impact and relationship it has on company culture. So to put it into context, my background as a former New York Yankee gave me the inspiration to start thinking about life and business in new ways, by using simple strategies to make big shifts. And I spend a lot of time speaking and working with companies and their leaders talking about how culture and leadership intersect and can create either what I call legendary teams or how this intersection can ruin an organization. So, with me today to talk about leadership from the perspective of how to lead better by not placing generational stigmas on people, which, by the way, is a great viewpoint, is Carl Bimshaw. Carl Bimshaw is a Boston-bred and California-chilled advisor and writer. His San Diego-based firm, Carl Bimshaw Consulting, focuses on existing strengths. I love that. And collaborates with busy professionals who run small businesses or large departments and want to manage better and lead well. Carl, welcome.
Well, thank you, Patrick. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, it's certainly a pleasure to meet you and, of course, discuss one of my favorite topics, which is leadership. And I'm sure many of those that are lighting up the Twitter universe out there love leadership as well. So before we get started, I just wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about anything additional you'd like to tell our audience about. Anything about yourself?
Well, just to build a little bit of context, I was a manager of Fortune 500 company for quite a while, had a good run there, then became a business development leader at a regional company, and then got the itch to go out on my own. And since 2009, I've been running my own leadership development and accountability firm. So I've got some leadership perspective and experiences from, you know, the boardroom to the kitchen table and everywhere in between. So I'm looking forward to today's discussion.
Yes, yes. And it seems to me companies are really trying to find opportunities to really differentiate with these strategies. So let me open up with talking about what is it when you resist the temptation to label people based on their generation, how is that a great benefit to leadership in your perspective?
Well, partly this came about because when you see the social media feeds and all that filled with how to deal with millennials and or the aging boomers or something like that, there's that little part of me as somebody from Generation X who has that stereotypical annoyed by everybody's getting the attention but me, right? But that really got me thinking over the years around it really has nothing to do with the generation. I mean, generational things are – it's a label and it's shorthand and it's to a certain extent marketing to be able to get some attention for – the story that you're telling, but I was reading a few articles today even that were talking about how to deal with particular millennials, and it has nothing to do about a generational influence or the technology they're using. It's how to deal with 20-year-olds. And so those are the types of things that I think we using generational labels is a shorthand and as a shortcut. And that's okay for some things. And you need those inputs if you're dealing with policy or dealing with millions of people. But when you're the leader or manager and you're dealing with your work group or your family or whatever size of your community is, that aggregate doesn't work. You've got to talk with people individually and get more into the individual, because there are people who don't feel like they're part of this generational label that they're in. And, you know, people have different backgrounds. And so, you know, labels are people want to be part of a tribe. They want to belong, but nobody really likes being labeled things, right? So that's where if you are able to strip away labels, and generation is sort of like the big label, but that works up and down, you know, from race to gender to, you know, orientations, anything. If you can get rid of the labels and actually talk to the person, then you're going beyond the headlines. And I think that's what you need to do as a leader is don't be just reading headlines. You got to get in there and be a better practitioner one-on-one with people.
Right. And so are you seeing benefits? Is it sort of understanding more of the employee's stage in their life in terms of where they are? Because that, I mean, people can fall into that generation but have different things going on in their life. Right? There's ways to uncover those clues, right?
That's exactly right. And so when if you just stick with the label, then you're saying, well, you don't know, you're a boomer, or you know, you don't know. The problem with the labels is it's always the generation that's, in power, or the generation who's leading, always thinks that the generation below it doesn't know what they're doing, right? And the younger generations are going to change the world no matter what. Well, that's more of a function of how people feel when they're in their 20s versus their 40s versus their 60s. It doesn't have to do with a generational trend. And so I think that the benefits are, yeah, if you can figure out what somebody in their 20s is going through and how they generally, you know, because people in their 20s, their aspirations and goals are the same, you know, in this year as they were in the 70s, as they were in the 1950s. There's different technology, but there's still certain aspirations. There's an ambivalence. There's sort of a sense of, you know, I'm awesome and the world is horrible and I'm going to go fix the world when you're in your 20s, right? And then that changes over time. So I think if we spend more time looking at where people are in stage of life, then we're cutting through some of the noise and becoming a better leader, because we're actually being more personal to people.
That's great. When you study success even over the years, I mean, all the millions of words that are in our dictionary of our library of words to use, I mean, there's only a few words if you study those that are successful over time, and they come down to, you know, hard work, dedication, focus, you know, trust, integrity, things like that. And so, you know, it's really interesting to understand these different trends in their stages in life. So tell me, why is it important to give immediate feedback? Do you think that's important today? I mean, depending either where someone is in their stage?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think feedback, you know, not just at work but everywhere is essential, right? And why you should do it, you know, immediate. I mean, feedback should be, to my mind, it should be fast, it should be frequent, it should be relevant, right? And it should generally be positive. And I think what happens with feedback is that people tend to hold it, and what happens is if it's positive, it dilutes over time, right? And if it's negative feedback, it, you know, maybe if it's acidic, it kind of corrodes over time. But holding feedback doesn't help. It's much better if you're using it right then and there. The closer to the event, the better. I mean, you think about organizations that are involved, like in quarterly recognition or things like that, and the recognition's great, but you're recognizing somebody for something that they did potentially 3 months ago, and there's a vacuum in time. So time creates the vacuum. So if somebody does something and you're not giving them feedback, either praising the progress or making some modifications or trying to redirect them in a direction that you want, whether the feedback is a positive or negative feedback, if you're waiting on it, people are going to fill the vacuum with their own story. And that's, you don't want that when you're leading and managing, right? You want them. So you know, I like what Ken Blanchard has said a lot, is, you know, kind of praise progress and reward things that are approximately right. People aren't going to get perfection right off the bat. But if you're not providing any feedback, you're allowing too much space for them to kind of create their own story, which could be they think they're the greatest in the world, but you didn't tell them that they needed to do something different. Or they could be thinking, well, they're horrible. I don't know, you know, no, they don't talk to me at all. I don't know what I'm doing. And you could have been, you know, pleased with them. So always act on your feedback is would be my point. I think if you sit on it, it dilutes and it loses its power and its effectiveness.
Right. Do you think there are reasons why people hesitate to be candid in that feedback? I mean, let's say it's you know, an opportunity to coach, develop, bring that person to the next level. Are you seeing trends of why leaders are they afraid from a compliance standpoint? What do you think in terms of why people resist from giving feedback?
I don't know that I'm seeing a trend in it. I think it's, again, partly on the person who's giving the feedback, their viewpoint, right? So there are those who think, well, you know, you're just supposed to do your job. What am I going to do, throw a parade if you tie your shoes correctly? You know, I mean, it's do what you're supposed to do, and, you know, you only get rewards and feedback if it's extra special or beyond, or if you're really screwed up or something, right? So partly it's the mindset of the person supplying the feedback. And I think you've got to be, as a leader, a little bit more well-rounded and remember that the feedback isn't for you. It's for the people who are helping you reach your goals, right, your teammates. And so feedback is like a gift, right? I think of it as like a gift that you get from your Christmas sweater that you get from your crazy aunt or something, right? You can either accept it or you can be one of those jerky people, say, I'll never wear this. But the right thing to do is say thank you, right, and then decide what you're going to do with it. So I think, you know, it's a two-way street. That's why it's feedback, right? So you've got to be able to deliver it effectively so that you're getting the results that you're aiming for, but you also have to be receptive to feedback and say, well, gee, is this true, or should I be ignoring this feedback because I don't, the person who's giving it to me hasn't proven any credibility or whatever it might be. But I'm not seeing a trend. I think answer your question, I think people don't like conflict as a general rule, or they're afraid of, like, well, I don't know if that's within, depending upon how restricted their environment is, well, I don't know if that's something I should give them feedback on or they should figure it out themselves. So I think it's mostly fear. People aren't providing feedback because they're afraid of something.
Sure. And sometimes that comes with assuming, right, making assumptions. Are there ways leaders can turn assumptions into empathy, sort of reflect on their own behavior to prove, like, the leader's own personal leadership instead of trying to change others?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think that assumptions, it's kind of ABT, right? With assumptions, you should always be testing. Generally, we think our assumptions are right, but as human beings, our assumptions usually don't pan out too well. I did an exercise a few years ago. I think it was from a Seth Godin idea or something like that, where you keep a journal of your assumptions for 90 days and then go back and see how many of them had come true versus not. And it's a great exercise to do in discipline, where you just kind of make some assumptions and see how it pans out over time. And you'll see that you're not nearly as right as often as you think you are. And so I think in terms of turning assumptions into empathy is if you test it. And so there's that kind of core attribute of a good leader is curiosity. So you may have an assumption, and it's like, well, let's turn it into a hypothesis and see if it's true or not. And by doing that, now you're creating some empathy because you're asking, you're listening, you're looking to learn. And that in itself is going to be a way of kind of changing any assumptions that you have. Instead of trying to have a follower do what you want them to do, if you're in there listening to them and probing and finding their strengths, you're going to have more success because then you can leverage those strengths to where you want to go.
Right, and this whole generational label begins with sometimes these assumptions. So tell me, what do you think, or describe what a leadership agenda means to you?
So a leadership agenda, it's partly a tool that I use with people also. If you just when you think of an agenda for staff meeting or meeting, hopefully you have one, right? And hopefully it's not hidden. But you lay out what it is that you want to achieve. So as a manager or leader, I mean, you should be questioning what your objective is, right? And asking yourself, okay, what kind of leader do I want to be or do I need to be in this culture at this place and this time, right? And asking yourself, like, how do I want to lead? And so that, by just asking that question, you start to kind of create a little bit of an agenda. And so the leadership agenda is how you plan on guiding your organization or your team over the next, fill in the time frame, next month, 90 days, year, whatever it might be. And so these are the things, this is how I want to lead, this is the tools I'm going to use. And so, I break it down into three elements: your attitude, your appearance, and your approach, right? So the attitude is sort of your inner game, right? So what are your beliefs, your values, kind of your compass, right? The what's your true north, right? So that's the attitude and your leadership attitude, right? Then the appearance is your outer game. It's how you show up. It's how you present yourself. So it's the grooming and speaking and all that, but it's also just how present are you? How mindful are you from a leadership appearance standpoint? Are you taking initiative, et cetera? And then finally, approach, which is basically your behavior, right, and how you're treating others. And so for an effective leadership agenda, you know where you're going, how you want to lead, and you're keeping those three things aligned.
That's great. So mentorship, this happens to be one way to learn this. I mean, I know those are some great ways to shift, but what do you think taking people to the next level, that coaching, managing process?
Right. So you're asking about, like, how to find the right mentor or get there through mentoring
something
like that?
Well, in order to develop this investment in others, to get leaders to make attitude shifts, it takes time and a commitment. I know you talked about being curious and working through the process. How important has that been for you, having mentors? Or are you just naturally curious?
Well, probably naturally curious, but mentors are crucial. But I think sometimes we put too much cachet on it in terms of, like, who's the right one. I mean, you can have a lousy mentor and learn an awful lot, right? You can learn a lot from a lousy leader.
And they change over time, right?
Right, exactly. And so I think, there is a whole world of mentorship and how to do it right and finding the right people and all that versus, a paid coach, or apprenticeship or something like that. I think the key for finding the mentor where you want to go is being a little less on the, let's say it's a mid-range goal as opposed to a long-term goal, which mentoring sometimes takes a longer view, where it's just like how you dress for success or you kind of dress for the job that you want, that whole kind of adage about, if you think about the corporate ladder, even if it's lateral, dress for the job that you want. I think you need to think about learning from people who are in the job that you want. And so instead of, if you're an entry-level person, instead of trying to get the ear of the CEO or something like that, maybe try to find the supervisor. And I think the key there is finding the people who have just recently, who are either going through or just recently went through what you want to do next, because you're going to get a fresher, truer, real feedback from them and experience as to what's going on and what they had to do and what they've gone through. When too much time passes, you kind of get a little bit of the gravitas and they clean up the history a little bit and they maybe forget some details that would have been important to know. So I think whether it's, even if you're aspiring to get a particular type of car or something like that, is go find the people who just bought that car. What'd you have to do? Where'd you find it? What's the good deal? So just with leadership, it depends on what you're going to work on. But I think ultimately, there's your skills, right, that got you there. And then there's what, HR tends to call the soft skills, but I call them their essential leadership skills, which are all the, the interpersonal skills, communication, influence, situational awareness, problem solving, just general professional acumen, all the things that if you screw up generally is what gets you into HR's office, you know, or like
right.
let's talk. Those are the things people ought to be working on. And so you want to find mentors, and those are very seldom, that's not a positional mentorship. That's people who just kind of get it, right? And so I think if you're looking for mentors, is figure out like which one of those essential leadership skills would you like to focus on over the next 6 months or something like that, and find people who you admire. Gee, you seem to understand body language real well, or you're great at presentations,
right.
or you're great, rather than, hey, how did you get to be VP, or how did you get that position? And think more about the skills that they're possessing, and that way it's a little bit more. Again, now we're breaking down that it's not a positional thing. It's more like, okay, what are the skills I want to learn from the best, and you're the best in my circle who's doing that. So I think, you know.
Right. Carl, are there specific, you know, for people in leadership, they want to improve their interaction with, you know, their direct reports or even within their organization, are there specific either attitude shifts or skill sets that they can develop?
Yeah, there's tons, but I think there's a couple
places
to start.
Where do we begin?
Yeah. So you're saying like an attitude shift, and they want to be improving. So, you know, they're fairly typical, but we tend to forget about them. So one is the empathy, right? If you understand what people are going through and are showing empathy or being there and just listening to them, then it's showing that you're listening, which is automatically a better leadership skill than some people have, right? So partly it's, and particularly if you're, this is where you can go from stage of life type thing. If you're somebody in your 40s or 50s, you know what people in their 20s and 30s and early 40s have gone through. So you already have some basic empathy, like, oh, I remember that. And you can share some stories and kind of be there for them or see, you know, just try to build some empathy there. So I think empathy is a big part of it. The other attitude. Which
yeah, and
why do
some people forget sort of that, you know, where they started and where their career originated from, and they lose touch of that empathy with their teams?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's where it's sort of related to that, is because if people forget, so because I mean, as you advance and get into the rhythm of things change, right? And as if you get known as the leader, become the leader, there tends to be a little bit of a deferential treatment to you one way or another, you know, whether you're leading the family or leading the little league team or the corporation, right? There tends to be some perks and some things that you're used to. And so you then begin to think that, well, gee, everybody's, since I'm experiencing this, everybody's experiencing this. And I think then sort of the other attitude shift is that gratitude, where you realize like all of this took time to get. All of it could potentially go away, right? That's the Stoic in me. It's like, you know, it could go away, you know, so you should show some gratitude. So that would be the other part because, yeah, people forget. And, you know, I think the other back to the attitude thing is you've got to be, as a leader, you've got to be able to teach. Because not everybody knows or gets your vision as a leader, right? So you've got to be able to teach them your vision. Not everybody gets to know your passion. You've got to be able to express and show and your passion. Not everybody gets or can match your level of action, right, or how often you're achieving the things that you're achieving. So that's where that being able to teach as a leader is an important attitude, as opposed to, you know, people should just get this. I don't know why people don't get this, right? I mean, you know, you shouldn't be punishing people who don't anticipate your whim, right?
So I think they took a different process usually to get there sometimes.
Right, and then that's where it kind of links back to curiosity, where instead of saying, now, not all of this works, like say in a manufacturing section or certain things where things have to be a certain way, but most
sure.
of our life is flexible. There's patterns, right? So the curiosity, back to that attribute, would be like, huh, how'd you get there? Well, that seems like, well, gee, that's better, right? Or, okay, that's great, but here's an unintended consequence down the line that we should look at. So I think if you have that curiosity, then you want to know what's the other path that people took instead of demanding this is the way you've got to go.
Right, and that teaching approach, I mean, people feel good when somebody's stopping, pausing, being empathetic and also understanding, you know, their perspective of the world. and taking that time as a leader. I mean, it means a lot to people. Would you agree that when their supervisor spends the time to coach and teach and relate to and show interest in them?
Yeah, because, I mean, ultimately everybody wants to feel that they matter, right? Now, it might be that people have a difference of opinion. Some people don't want, like, public recognition, right? That just assume, you know, just send me a plaque or the money or vacation or something like that. I don't need
right.
applause in front of everybody. But it still shows that, hey, what you did matters. And so fundamentally people want to – I mean, people are motivated by, you know, increasing their relationships with people they like, working on something bigger than themselves, or leaving some type of legacy, right? And when they get that validation or that permission, for lack of a better word, from leaders, they feel better, and they're going to put it in, regardless of what stage of life they're in or what generation they're in. It's just people being listened to and making a difference is one of the better motivational tools, you know.
Yeah, it affects their confidence too, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah. So tell me, where do you begin? Tell me about where you began in this process. I'm curious.
Well, where I began.
How
like,
did you
where
get to
I
the
began?
Fortune 500? Yeah.
Oh, well. I'm not entirely sure how to answer that. I'd say I've always been interested in getting better and improving things. So there's a little bit of that perfectionist, but realizing that you're not, so being able to let go. So, I mean, I used to listen to my dad's old tapes, you know, Earl Nightingale and Dennis Waitley and all the other old gurus. And I would used to, now, so here's a generational thing, right? I used to listen to those tapes over and over until they wore down. Yeah. What do you mean tapes? So that kind of formed a baseline. And then in terms of being involved in some of the other companies, so I could talk forever, so I'm trying to edit. I don't know where to go. I think there's always a thirst of, you know, there's that leadership part, right? That's where I was thinking, is like people who manage or lead, right? It's not necessarily a particularly easy job, but people who enjoy it, who are in it, can't imagine doing anything but it. And when they're not in it, they're not as happy. So even though there's things that they can, you know, managers together will moan and groan about certain things. Well, why can't people do this, or why doesn't that happen, right? But they love the challenge. And so I have found, you know, in terms of working with people and doing leadership things and all that, I love working with people and those challenges and the problems that arise. I'm a little sick like that. I like the problems that people bring and working on that and solving that. So I've always enjoyed that. So that's kind of where that comes from, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, and getting to see people develop. I mean, being a developer of – I mean, you're really developing a business, producing products, services – But you know, the people are what make all of that happen. So it is exciting to get out there and see change. I'll tell you, Carl, this was a lot of fun to share the time. I enjoyed being the host today, and I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to tell the audience. The Twitter universe here is lighting up. We've got a lot of great conversations happening there, and I want to make sure that we all get the opportunity to ask the questions and get involved in the show after. So make sure that we carry this conversation and light up the Twitter universe, as Megan would share. So tell me, Carl, do you have any lingering thoughts that you want to leave our audience with at this time?
I guess it would just be that we touched on it a little bit. Like when you're in management and leadership and you really like it, there's sometimes you do tend to, you know, read every book, go to every seminar, and generally almost kind of become a little bit of a leadership junkie, where you're taking everything on and reading everything. And while I think that's great, I love people to buy everybody's stuff, I think sometimes, like, I'm more impressed with somebody who reads one book 10 times than somebody who reads 10 books. because I think if you can kind of really get in to something and work on something, you got to be able to not just be book smart. You got to get out there and learn and make mistakes and learn how to apologize and learn how to fix things. And I think that those who are in leadership positions and can't quite muster that should be thinking about individual contributor positions. You can have a great career being an individual contributor and not be messing up people's lives, right? So I think as a leader, you should always be finding ways to manage better and always ways to lead well. And I guess that's where I would leave it.
All right. Thank you, Carl. Let's head on over to Twitter and join the conversation.
Sounds great. Looking forward to it. Thanks so much.
All right. You bet. Take care.